Hello, welcome to episode 9 of the Structure and Interpretation of Computer Programmers podcast. Once again, a bored man has got access to a microphone and is going to use it to be wrong on the internet. I should note that as I'm recording on Thursday 25th of June, the temperature outside is sweltering, and indeed inside. It is well above 30 degrees Celsius and 90 degrees Fahrenheit in the UK, both indoors and outdoors. I have the door to the outside world open, so you get to experience not only my dulcet tones, but also the background noise of my garden and of the town of Warwick. Today's topic is going to be design by contract, which is a subject I was requested by a listener early in the podcast's life. Obviously, I've been very excited by working on Amiga Smalltalk lately, so had yet to get around to it, but here we are. I want to start by sort of situating the idea of design by contract in a progression of theoretical thought about computer programming. And I'm going to start with a monograph by Edgar Dijkstra called A Discipline of Programming, and there'll be a link to that in the show notes. This is a really nice small book that demonstrates how to think about computer programs in terms of a sort of mathematical predicate logic, sort of philosophical notation, if you like. And the way it does that is to construct a programming language, a simple imperative programming language with like do loops and if statements and so on, by exploring what the possible different mathematical transformations that a program could make in a single expression are, and enumerating those possibilities. So the simplest expression is the empty statement, the no operation, which leaves everything exactly the same. The next simplest is the abort statement, which, given any precondition, terminates the program. And then he adds the assignment statement, which, for any precondition, turns the state of the computer into a state that's identical to the initial conditions, except that the variable that you assigned now has this new value. And it builds up from there. Each of these statements is kind of defined in terms of its weakest precondition, i.e. given that you want a particular outcome from this statement, and we give a discussion of what the mechanics of this statement are, what is the loosest set of conditions that can hold in order for that transformation to lead to the desired outcome. And what this gives you is, firstly, the ability to think about how a program should work in terms of its inputs, outputs, and its preconditions. So a program for computing the greatest common divisor, given two numbers as the input, we want the output to be the GCD of those two numbers. And the way you get there from knowing what the weakest preconditions of each of the expressions is that you can combine these expressions. If you know that a particular precondition holds before expression one, and you know what transformation expression one makes, and you know what transformation expression two makes, then you know what the post condition is going to be if you follow expression one by expression two. Similarly, if you know what post condition you're trying to achieve, i.e. what final outcome you want, then you can work backwards, sort of prepending statements to each other, until you get to the preconditions that you are able to satisfy. So if you can make assertions about how the initial and final state of the computer with relation to every expression in your programming language are related, then you can make assertions about whole programs and their behavior, or about fragments of programs and their behavior, by essentially chaining the results of these transformations. So you can say that for a function f, given a particular set of predicates, or preconditions, the outcome is the predicate that is derived by chaining the transformations caused by all of the statements that are in that function. Now let's introduce on top of this the idea of structured programming. Let's take advantage of this ability to combine assertions by defining routines or functions or procedures, whatever you want to call them, where we can replace the knowledge of how every single statement works and is sequenced within those procedures with a statement about what we need for the function to work, i.e. the function's preconditions or the procedure's preconditions, and what that function or procedure will guarantee to be true at the end, what its postconditions are, assuming that those preconditions were satisfied. And let's compose programs in blocks where we understand what the effects of each block are, and therefore we can combine those blocks and understand what the behavior of the overall program is. Or we can compose those blocks into larger blocks and then write a statement about how that block is going to work, and then use that block, that larger component, in the construction of another block or of a program. So we're going to build a sort of hierarchy of chunks of computer program, where because we know how all of the expressions work, we can replace knowledge of the sequence of expressions with knowledge of the result of carrying out that sequence of expressions. And we can allow these blocks or functions or procedures to stand in, mentally speaking, for that list of procedures, that list of expressions that are in the procedure. One thing we have to do in order to make this reliable is we have to get rid of the go-to statement. And Dijkstra wrote about this as well in a letter to the communications of the ACM, which the then editor, Niklaus Wirth, titled go-to statements considered harmful. The problem with a go-to statement is that if we want a function to have this precondition and postcondition that we understand, if we want the sequence of expressions to have a sort of deterministic outcome for a given initial state, well, we'd better understand what that initial state is. And if we've got a go-to statement, then we can't look at the program that has run to this point and decide that the postcondition of that earlier chunk of the program is the initial state that needs to satisfy the precondition of the next chunk of the program, because we might not have come through by following the program in a straight line. We might have jumped from some earlier point with a go-to statement to here without executing a chunk of the earlier part of the program. Or we might have come from a later part of the program and jumped back here with no without sort of resetting the state back to what it would have been. In fact, if we did reset the state back to what it would have been, then there probably isn't any point in having the go-to in the first place. So go-to introduces arbitrary disconnections in the control flow of the program. What we want is known disconnections. We want the program counter to move in known ways so that we know what the possible conditions are when we're looking at an expression, because we can resolve them from the possible finite list of histories that the program can have had to get to this point. So this, yeah, that's a bit of a side quest, but that's why we don't have go-to statements in programming languages anymore. Now, I've been using these phrases, precondition and postcondition, and you can tell that what we're talking about is effectively a sort of, definitely a temporal model of a machine, but not one that actually has a sort of wall clock meaning of time, but one that has a like a sequential meaning of time. The computer clicks from one state to another. Very much the definition of a computing machine in Alan Turing's papers. And I'll put a link to his On Computable Numbers paper into the show notes too. So we've got this idea that the machine clicks from one state to another and that some transformation occurs in that state. It could be that the computer causes some action to happen, like writing a letter to a paper tape or storing some information on a disk or displaying something on a screen. It could be that the computer updates its own internal state. It changes a register on the CPU, or it changes a location in memory, or it receives some information from a source, you know, from a paper tape, from a punch card, from a floppy disk, from a SSD, from a keyboard, from a pointing device, whatever, and uses that to update its internal state. And that the program is being modeled as a series of these ticks and a series of these either events or changes in state. But that we can, rather than look at each of these individual changes in state and have to think about all of them in sequence, we can say we understand how this sequence works, and we're going to replace our understanding of all of the expressions in that sequence with our understanding of the outcome of that sequence. So we're going to pretend that in a single tick, the computer actually ticks, you know, the 27 or however many expressions there are in that function, and replaces its initial state with the outcome of that state. And that's the thing that allows us to build contracts. We, you know, a contract in computer programming design is essentially like a contract in the real world, you know, in sort of relations between companies or people, or people and companies. You know, we say, if I do this for you, then I expect you to do that for me. Well, the preconditions are what I'm saying I'll do for you. You know, I will guarantee that when you come to do this work, I will have got the materials that you need. I will have found you space. I will have made sure that the resources are available for whatever time. In return for which, I expect you to write me a killer app, cut my hair, whatever the thing is that I'm engaging you for. So a software design contract is saying, if the core programmer arranges for the computer to be in one of these sets of states, and obviously those sets can be very large, so what we actually do is look at only the relevant parts of the state. So if these parts of the environment are in this condition when you call this function, then the result of this function will be, and the post conditions express something about the results. And these are usually universal quantifiers. So for any situation in which the precondition holds, every predicate in the post condition will be true. And there's one other thing that we look at as well, which is invariants, which are basically things that don't change, hence invariant. not quite during the execution. What we usually say is that the invariants are true both at the beginning and the end. We allow them to vary during execution of a function because of this idea that we're not actually looking, that we pretended that the computer ticked from the initial state to the final state without ticking through all of the intermediate states. At least nobody was looking at the time that it ticked through those intermediate states. So that's how we could build contracts from computer programs. But let's flip that. In the same way that test-driven development flipped the idea that we could test software into the idea that we could build software by making it pass a set of tests that we'd already designed, let's come up with the idea that I can create a contract, I can design what I want my function to do. Given two numbers, I want the function to return the greatest common divisor of those numbers. And I can then build my function such that it satisfies that contract. So I've designed the interface. I know that I need to give it two numbers, and I know that it's going to return the GCD, which is also a number. So I've got a function that takes two numbers and returns a number, very much like TDD makes me think about how this function signature is going to look by thinking about how it's called rather than thinking about how to expose the implementation details of the function. And I build and test the implementation by making the implementation of the function perform the whatever transformations are needed such that the outcome of the precondition being true is the postcondition being true and the invariants not changing. And there is plenty of work in this region, certainly from before object-oriented programming. There's a field called formal methods, which is essentially the application of mathematics to computer program modeling, and then the building of computer programs that behave in accordance with those models. One example, which is one I'm familiar with because it was a lot of work on it was done at my university at Oxford, is the Z notation, or Z notation, I suppose, for our transatlantic audience. And there'll be a link in the show notes to a wiki page on the Z notation from the formal methods wiki. Design by contract is basically doing that for object-oriented programming, taking this idea that I know what the preconditions, postconditions, and invariants of a function are, and applying it to the situation where I have methods on objects, and objects defined as instances of classes. Think of an object in this context as like a small computer, so an encapsulated environment with some of its own state and memory that is available for privileged access to the functions that are the methods on that object, and is unavailable for any access whatsoever by any other code, methods on other objects, or free functions or anything. So that the only places where you can change or even observe that piece of encapsulated state is in the methods. Now, what were preconditions in our function are now preconditions that describe the initial state of the object and the arguments to the function. And postconditions, which were previously about the state of the computer and the return value of the function that we were considering, are now constraints on the return value of the function still, and the subsequent state of that object's environment. And that obviously makes it much more concise and easier to think about what the precondition and postcondition and invariant constraints are, because you're no longer thinking about all of the memory and registers on the computer. You're thinking about the small number of immediate values that are the memory of this object. That is the state that's available to any object's methods. As a side quest, Bertrand Meyer, who wrote about design by contract in his book Object-Oriented Software Construction, also imposed further constraints by introducing a design principle called command query separation. Command query separation says that you can basically ask an object a question, or you can change its state, but you don't do both on the same method. So you could have a, take a simple example, a light switch. You can have a method that asks whether the light is on or off, and you can have a method that toggles the state of the light, but you don't have a method that toggles the state and tells you the new state, or toggles the state and tells you the old state. You separate these things. And now you know that a method is either going to return a value that is derived from the state of the object, or it is going to update the state of the object, but not both. And that further constrains the things that you have to consider in the contracts for that method. It's very much related to the Eiffel environment, but design by contract doesn't have to be done in Eiffel. You can do this in pretty much any programming language. With many design ideas in programming, like functional programming or object-oriented programming or formal methods, the tools can make it easier. They typically don't make it possible. You could definitely write object-oriented programming in assembly language. You could definitely write design by contract in assembly language. You could definitely write pure functions and lambdas and curried functions in assembly language. All that the specific notation of your programming language is doing is making it easier to express some ideas. Eiffel was designed to make it very easy to express design by contract, and very easy to use the contracts in designing and in developing software. And it was probably one of the first object-oriented systems after Clue, which was designed by Barbara Liskov, among others, to define objects in terms of abstract data types, which is an idea that was subsequently taken on in some languages like Java, C Sharp and Swift, but not in others like Smalltalk, Objective-C, Ruby, JavaScript and so on. So the idea that an object exists in an inheritance hierarchy is common to a lot of programming languages, or I should probably specifically say that the class exists in some kind of inheritance hierarchy. The idea that that inheritance hierarchy is connected to some notion of typing, and that the type of a subclass is a constrained subset of the type of its parent class, is not universal in object-oriented programming. It's definitely something that languages like Clue and Eiffel and Java have, and that languages like Smalltalk and Ruby do not. But, as I said, this is only a this is only a syntax that makes modelling your program in this particular way easier to express. You could entirely design your object model with abstract data types and with contracts away from the computer, and so there is an object Z extension to the Z notation. There are other formal methods notations that allow you to model your object system using contracts or using other mathematical structures, which you then implement by following the model, but not necessarily by expressing all of that detail in the final program. So why am I talking about this? Why is design by contract something that's interesting to me? I find it a more general way to design like an object based on its desired behavior than TDD is. You know, often TDD, you come up with particular examples of what the program should do, and you express those examples as tests. And it may be that you miss out some error cases or more complex inputs or boundary conditions that you just don't think of at the time that you write the tests. With design by contract, what you're doing is you're making universal statements about the outcome of using a particular method or about the changes to an object. Whenever these preconditions hold, using this function will result in these postconditions being true. Those universal truths can be tested through an explicit test activity, but they can also just be left in the program as runtime assertions that can then be validated in production even. You know, if someone reports a bug, you can ask them to turn on all of the contract checks and see whether you get an assertion failure before the bug is met, and therefore narrow down which function is misbehaving and not fulfilling its contract. So what I've done in relation to this is to build two design by contract systems. One is called Coco by Contract, which is written in Objective-C but works from Objective-C or Swift. And the other is Java by Contract, which is written in Java but would work in any JVM language. And the way that they work is that you define your contract on the class that is implementing the methods, but then you introduce a proxy that intercepts calls to any of the API of that class and tests the preconditions first, then executes the method, and then checks the invariants and the postconditions afterwards. So you get to either use the class directly, having designed it by contract, and not have all of these checks, or introduce these checks and get runtime failures whenever your program doesn't satisfy its contract. Now, there were other implementations of design by contract in Java. Most of them were quite old, and so due to constraints in earlier versions of the Java programming language, you wrote your contract essentially in comments around your method, and then had a translator that would introduce those into the code as assertions, and only worked in very limited circumstances. What I've done is used the Reflection API and annotations that can be attached to methods and to types to make the make the contract a part of the runtime model of the object. And the advantages are, one, that you are just writing in normal Java, which your IDE understands. You're not like writing in weird additional syntax that has to be transformed into Java. And two, that the annotations appear as part of the class documentation. So if you use JavaDoc, you get your contract as part of the API documentation, which it is. It is a statement about how you use these methods and what the result will be of using them in the right way. I want wanted, when I created these libraries, to make them part of a property-based testing workflow. So property-based testing is an idea that you have an explicit test phase like running unit tests, but rather than having individual examples, you have quantified examples. So you have, for any situation where the inputs are like this, we expect the outputs to be like this, which is very much the same statement that you're trying to make when you write down the contract of a method. So my idea was that, as well as being able to validate these contracts at runtime, you could have a computer generate a collection of cases that were consistent with the preconditions, and then execute them and confirm that the postconditions were indeed true, and that this could be part of a continuous integration pipeline. I haven't done that yet, and I've got distracted by other tasks. But I definitely when I design objects, I think about them in terms of the contracts. I think about what methods I need in terms of what I want to do and what I want the outcome of those operations to be, and how those combine to ensure that my object is always consistent, and that, you know, one of the methods can't leave the object in a state where one of the other methods can no longer behave correctly. So this design also helps if you do have inheritance in your object structure. It helps to enforce the idea of like the Liskov substitution principle in your design, because if what we require is for the subtype to be usable, but be replaceable for instances of the parent type, then what we require is that the preconditions on its API must be the same as or looser than the preconditions on the parent type, i.e. anywhere that I've satisfied the parent conditions, I have also satisfied the child conditions. And I require the post conditions of each of the operations to be at least as strict, if not stricter, than the post conditions on the parent type, i.e. anything that is true of a program that uses the parent type is also true of a program that uses the derived type. And part of my reason for doing this, and then for also talking about it on the podcast, is that I would like to sort of build a community of other developers who are using this design approach, because I think it does lead to better designs and better quality in a way that, you know, TDD started. It kind of takes that further. TDD makes us consider the design from this sort of empathetic situation of thinking about how this thing will be used, and design by contract combines that with thinking about everything, every situation in which an object could be used. What are the things we need to do to ensure that it behaves correctly? And sometimes TDD tests tend to be coupled to their implementation in ways that makes it harder to change the implementation of an object. It's proponents of TDD often talk about the fact that it makes it safer and easier to change your code because you've got these tests backing you up. But in practice, people who are trying to adopt TDD often sort of expose properties of their objects that maybe would otherwise be private, in order to make statements about tests, or to create tests that are deterministic and reliable, but that then mean that those implementation details are part of the object's guarantees now. They have to exist, and so changing the implementation is limited by the collection of tests that the programmers have come up with. Whereas with design by contract, because you're making very high level statements about what is universally true before and after running a method, you say nothing about what goes on inside the method. You say nothing about what goes on inside the object, just that the object will be in this state at the end, given that it was in this state at the beginning. And so that leads to a more flexible implementation, because it kind of keeps you at the external level of the object when you're designing your contracts. Anyway, that's all for this episode. Thank you very much for listening. As ever, I welcome any feedback. You can email me, GrahamLee@acm.org. Thanks very much. Stay safe, stay cool, and I will talk to you next time.